Once again, thanks so much, Vince. Now for our final presentation of these three days, I'd like to welcome Mr. Julian Morton Moses. Mr. Moses is going to be introduced by Michael Sherman, who worked with Kurt Nauck earlier. And I can't exactly recall the circumstances, but Michael and I got into some kind of small correspondence. And I said, well, gee, Michael, why don't you do the introduction for Mr. Moses? Because we were talking about what a great idea it would be to have Mr. Moses on the program. So here's Michael to do the introduction, and I will step aside. And welcome, Michael, and welcome, Mr. Moses.
Thank you very much, Holly. The speaker you are about to hear himself heard Antonio Scotti sing at the Met, and is no mere child on the arm of a father, but is a reviewer for the City College of New York newspaper. For three quarters of a century, Julian Morton Moses has collected, bought, sold, reviewed, appraised, demonstrated, researched, written about, and otherwise immersed himself in the recorded legacy left us by the great singers and instrumentalists of our time. And he has done so with a passion and competence few are privileged to enjoy. In 1936, Mr. Moses wrote and published The Record Collector's Guide, acknowledged to be the first book ever written on collecting early recordings. In fact, at the time of its publication, some of the records listed were still available from their original manufacturers, and albums filled with acoustic records still resided in living rooms rather than attics. The legendary P.G. Hearst described his book in the Gramophone as a publication which steps automatically into history on the strength of its contribution to our knowledge of pioneer recording. Collectors may rest assured that the work has been well and truly done. Mr. Moses, who is a person of some musical consequence in New York, is thoroughly steeped in the traditions of our craft. During the late 1930s, Mr. Moses edited the Record Collector's Corner in the American Music Lover magazine and produced a radio show on rare records, broadcast over station WQXR. In 1939, he opened the Classical Record Shop in the heart of New York's musical district, and for the next 27 years, with the assistance of Christopher Bruno, established this store as a mecca for collectors the world over. Dozens of celebrities, including Stokowski, Toscanini, Horowitz, Ponzel, Martinelli, were regular patrons, and numerous other noted personalities outside the field of music shopped there for both rarities and current releases. Despite the pressures of managing a growing business, Mr. Moses published his Collector's Guide to American Recordings in 1949, the culmination of 25 years of painstaking and meticulous research. Far more than a simple checklist, it contains, in the words of Lady Compton Mackenzie, Mr. Moses' terse, pithy, and uncommonly sound judgments on the artists. The book received widespread critical review and was listed in the Encyclopedia Britannica, Grove's Dictionary of Music, and the American Library Association Guide to Reference Books as an essential reference. Dover Books agreed, republishing the book in 1977. In 1952, Mr. Moses published the Companion Price Guide to Collector's Records, which underwent two revisions, the latest in 1976. Since his retirement, Mr. Moses has remained active in the history of recorded music, continuing to lecture and present demonstrations of early recorded music. In 1980, he was awarded a fellowship for independent research by the National Endowment for the Humanities. So what am I doing here? In 1992, as part of the marketing effort for my book on Victor Records, I was going through the ARC's membership list. I ran across Mr. Moses' name and thought to myself, he's still alive? On my letter to him, I offered him a complimentary copy of the book and thanks for the many hours of pleasure and discographical questions answered by his book. About a week later, Mr. Moses called me. You could have knocked me over with a feather. Not only was I talking to the father of American celebrity record collecting, but a personal idol as well. When Mr. Moses expressed his interest in finding a publisher for a third revised edition of his book, I was only too eager to assist. We worked together for about a year, and it was with great pleasure that I was able to deliver a copy of American Celebrity Recordings, 1900 to 1925, the third edition of his book, to him last September. I will share just one or two excerpts from a review which appeared by the distinguished British discographer Alan Kelly, who wrote in the March 1994 issue of The Record Collector. Moses can fairly be described as the man who put the record collecting business in the States into the realm of proper hobbies. His contribution was much more than the formation of a collection. He collected with curiosity, took the trouble to study his subject in great depth, and finally systematized his knowledge and made it available to all who had similar interest, but no chance at all of obtaining the information firsthand. The final thing which must be considered are the notes, which are of great interest, much to the point, perceptive, and good-humored. Of course, the book does not attempt to be encyclopedic. For that kind of treatment, you must look elsewhere. What it does, however, is provide a thorough look at the coverage of celebrity material sold in America in the first quarter of the century in a form which is easily readable and invaluable as a quick reference. Without further ado, you didn't come to hear me, you came to hear him. It is with great pleasure that I'm here to Julian Moses.
With that introduction, I don't think the need to go ahead with my speech at all. However, I've been asked to do so, and I'll try. The kind of talk I will give is in the nature of oral history, which has become a very popular medium today, hoping that people who indulge in it will give forth with pieces of information that will not be found readily elsewhere and might contain some, important tidbits, maybe titillating tidbits that wouldn't be put into print. And so, although I will start in a sort of chronological order, I will skip around from here to there. My whole notes are on these two pages, but I am going to see what each item here suggests to my memory and hope that it brings forth something of interest and information to you, something that will add to your knowledge of the record history and record world. Friends have suggested that although this has a particular date in history from which to start, that in order to make it clear how I got to that particular point in history, I should indulge just a little bit in prehistory. And so I will start in the year 1921, when I was 10 years old. And my father, who had been an amateur violinist with a great interest in grand opera and baseball, introduced me to recordings of great singers by going out, buying a machine, and buying records for me. I remember the first three records he bought for me. They were Caruso's Cuius Animam from Stabat Mater, Caruso's own song, Dreams of Long Ago, and Lambert Murphy singing the Cuius Animam from Stabat Mater. He wanted to show me how each of the two approached and took the high note differently. His own favorite singer, because he had a wonderful bass voice himself, was Paul Plançon, because he said he had the most wonderful pitch of any singer. And my dad will occur later in my talk, if I get to that particular point. My dear mother was also a great lover of opera. Her favorite was Johanna Gatzky. Unfortunately, she died when I was 16 years old in 1928 and didn't live to share in my history in the record world and business. I should add, by the way, that my father left, which I still have, a bound edition this thick of all the programs of the Metropolitan Opera for the years 1899 to 1900. It's fabulous. Everyone you can think of, the Doreshkis, Melba, Tanina, everyone is there. He also left, when he died, a series of diaries from January 1st, 1900 to mid-1952, when he died, And in the early years are listed all the operas he went to and all the singers he heard. And then he bought me Victor books of the opera as they came out. And this intrigued me so much that I spent days and days reading those books and copying down numbers. I have a great love for numbers. I don't know why. A psychoanalyst could probably explain it to you. I'll jump a little ahead till when I went to high school. I went to high school and at a school connected with City College of New York, a preparatory school. I lived in Harlem, and in walking home, I passed along 125th Street, stores, old stores that were still devoted to records. And what one could still find in the late 1920s were remarkable things. One thing I remember was a store that had all the opera discs. Now, the opera discs, for those of you who don't know, were pressings of Victor and HMV recordings that were smuggled here because during World War I, they had lost the rights. And not only did I get some wonderful recordings, the very best acoustic recording I ever heard of Caruso, his Mi Pa Du Dir Encore from Pearl Fishers, recorded in Milano in 1904, given a Victor number, which I note in my book here, but never pressed in this country, and it was beautiful. And the pressing was beautiful. I'll jump a little bit ahead and then go to the original start. I founded the Concert Bureau at City College in 1929, and in addition to getting tickets to the Met for half price and to the Philharmonic for 25 cents and to oodles of concerts for nothing, I decided why not sell records? So I tried various companies, but they wouldn't bother with me. Luckily, Telefunken Company was just starting here. So they allowed me to sell their records. And I remember the first record I sold was Gertrude Bilgenagel singing the Ocean from Oberon, a fabulous recording. Okay, now we're up to a certain date, which is mentioned by in a speech, which our dear friend Rob Darrow wrote. Gave that speech here 8 years ago, the last time we met in New York. He was the guest of honor. And in his speech, he spoke of the original gramophone shop encyclopedia, which had come out that year. He said, the printed copies actually materialized around July 1st, 1936. Nearly simultaneously, incidentally, with a pioneering specialized discography, Julian Morton Moses' Record Collector's Guide, reviews promptly came flooding in, not only without exception favorable, but also, for the most part, incredibly non-critical raves. Well, I must say, the same was true of my book. And as I say into the introduction to my new edition, I was completely amazed by the reception. I had not expected it. There were reviews in the New York Times, in the Chicago Tribune Book Review, in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Paris. Well, I know it wasn't due to the name of Moses, important as that name was. It was because I, for the first time, was talking about Caruso and Patti and Melba and Plançon and all these people who were still fresh in the memory of reviewers of that day. I question whether the average music reviewer today would even know who Johanna Gotsky or Paul Poncelet was. Times have greatly changed. But I was very lucky, because of those reviews, I immediately was contacted by Peter U. Reed, who edited the American Music Lover, now called the American Record Guide. And I see that Rob Darrell was a little long, at least in my date, because I have here July 1936, in which Peter U. Reed announces that I will be conducting a record collector's corner in his magazine. And naturally, I must have gotten him before July 1st for him to have done this. Not only did he contact me, but people from all over the world wrote me, "It's wonderful to talk about these records, but where can we get them?" Well, it didn't take much intelligence. I don't know how much I had of a business sense in those days, or have even ever since, or I'd be a lot better off than I am today after all these many years. But I started something called the American Record Collectors Association and offered an auction sheet of rare cutout recordings. Pete Reed was kind enough to let me use the American Music Lover as an address to which people can write. At first, I had thought not to put out records only of my own, I didn't have that many, but to invite other collectors to participate, and we'd share in the proceeds. One such collector was Ellie Hirschman. Is there anyone here who knows of Ellie Hirschman? Well, Ellie Hirschman was a character. He wore, well, when you went to his home, he wore a bird on his head and was typing away his sheets. And his sheets were something else again. He had to fill up every space so that he'd list a record here, let's say a sale list, not just an auction list. He'd list a record here, and then the price would be down here somewhere, and you couldn't figure out which applied to which. He was a great guy. We remained friends for years, but I soon discovered that it was not to be a mutual venture, so to speak. And so I changed the name to American Record Collectors Exchange, which was registered with the City of New York in 1939, and it's still in existence. I was also, as Mr. Sherman said, asked to conduct a program over radio station QXR, which I did, and did not continue too long, because in their great wisdom, they put me on Saturday afternoons at the same time as the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts. Well, nobody was going to listen to me if they were could listen to a live Giulia Poncelle or what have you. Now, come to think of it, Giulia wasn't there anymore by that time, and neither, and Poncelle had left, but they had other very great singers, as you well know, Tibbet and others. Another thing that the book brought about was a call from a man named Jack L. Caden. Now, Caden had a very strong influence on record business for a long time. But when I met him, he had a little office at 1123 Broadway. He really was a glove salesman who, in his tours around the country, picked up records and brought them back hoping to sell them. But he didn't know too much about them. So he called me. And I said, "Well, you don't have enough good things here. Let's go on a trip." And the first trip we made, which must have been in July or August 1936, was down to Philadelphia. I had relatives in Philadelphia. I knew it was a very good town, being near to Camden, where Victor made its records. But in this particular case, we went to a warehouse called Wiles, which was, I believe, on 2nd Street, South 2nd Street, maybe Market or Walnut, certainly not far from the river. And it was a sprawling building. We went inside, and a man said, "What do you want?" And we said, "We're looking for records." He said, "Records? What are those?" We said, "You know, things you play and listen to." He said, "Oh, those things." He says, "They're on the top floor." So it was one of these kind of elevators, and we got ourselves up to the top floor, and we looked around. We said, "Where are the records?" He said, "Do you see lifesavers?" We said, "Lifesavers? Yeah, yeah." He said, "You know, the kind you swim with." He said, "Well, take the lifesavers down from the wall, and you'll find records." So I don't know how many hot July or August hours we spent pulling those lifesavers off the wall, but there, sure enough, was a complete stock of Edison cylinders in their original boxes, six of a number to a box, everything you could dream of. All the operatic, Schlesak and whatnot, Mae West, Sophie Tucker, so forth. So Caden said, "How much are they going to be?" I said, "Let me find out." I yelled, I said, "How much are these old records?" He said, "5 cents a piece." I said, "Okay." So we filled the car and brought them back to New York. And Caden said, "What are we going to do with all these records?" I said, let me handle it. I got in touch immediately with one of the few collectors I had known from the past, who was a very wealthy man. And he bought, I don't know, maybe 100 at $3.50 a piece. This convinced Caden that I knew records and would be worthwhile. Unfortunately, his wife didn't think so. And rather than to continue in a relationship that had this disagreeable element in it, I said to Jack, "Let's split for now. I'll do my own mail order business, and I'm sure you'll prosper." And prosper he did indeed, because he opened a store first at 48th Street near Radio City, and then eventually his very prominent store, the Collector's Record Shop, at 825 7th Avenue. And from that shop, he put out records of his own, the CRS records, which you may have seen. Caruso, he took the two Caruso Pathés that were not ever recorded elsewhere and made a 78 out of those two. And he had everybody, Lily Lehman. He had Valentino. He had Lillian Russell. And that's something amazing, I remember. The Russell record was "Come Down My Evening Star." And instead of a forceful, blatant voice, you would imagine, it was a sweet, angelic voice, as though she was singing Ave Maria. But his records sold, and he had a good business there, although he himself, was not exactly compatible with record collectors. He had low opinion of them and didn't attempt to disguise it. But meanwhile, I was selling records through the mail, and I finally, I guess in 1937 or eight maybe, moved downtown from Harlem, where I was born and had lived all my life. And my dad and I had a nice apartment with a separate entrance to the front room. And that room we made into a sort of little record store, and people came. I remember Francis Robinson and many other good friends, unfortunately not here anymore, who came and bought records. And I went around wherever I could buying them. And I will say that business was good enough. Well, not that good, but good enough so that my father said, "Let's try to find a store." He, being a native New Yorker, knowing a great deal about the city, with a very wonderful personality, went around, and sure enough, on the very corner of 53rd Street and 6th Avenue, which would now be the corner of the Hilton Hotel, he found a little store, a very, very small store, which we rented for $40 a month, and we were in business. We were in business. And whatever records, you know, I bought there. And for a while, I tried to sell them, at a price as near as possible to half of what was written on the label. And I even had a subtitle for my store, The Half Price Record Shop. In a little while, I saw how silly that was because I was giving away things much less than what they could bring. So I raised prices, and by word of mouth, people started to rename me the One and a Half Price Record Shop, at which time I made prices very variable and still very cheap, I must say. Also in that building, my father met the widow of Oscar Hammerstein, and it turned out that they knew each other somewhat because his brother had worked for Hammerstein, his whole family, and he had been in part of the theater business for a long time. I never got to meet her somehow. Well, New York was a fascinating place at that time. Records, as I mentioned before about opera discs, could still be found. And I collected catalogs too. I had this fascination. Wherever I went, I insisted, do you have any catalogs? And sure enough, a lot of them never bothered with catalog. I say in my book that catalogs were free and practically nobody failed to throw them away. But record dealers were more apt to keep them. And I started my collection of catalogs, which is now so vast that it threatens to asphyxiate me or evict me from our apartment. I really don't know which, one of the two. Well, to go on a little further, I also had been interested in jazz because I was brought up in Harlem. I heard Duke Ellington when he was in the pit of the Lowe's 124th Street Theater. And a friend of mine, Max Margolis, was very intimate with a couple of refugees, Lyons and Wolf, who wanted to put out a record of their own called Blue Note, but they didn't have money. So my first venture was to lend them money to put out the first Blue Note. I recall they were mostly artists from the village. I believe Meads Lux Lewis and Albert Ammons were the first two pianists, and Frankie Higginbotham and others. But after a year or so, they said, well, they didn't really need my money anymore, so if I take my money back with a certain amount of records thrown in as an interest, so to speak. So I was quickly out of the jazz record business, and very unfortunately, too, because to this day, Blue Note is a great seller. Another person I met about that time, I don't know whether he contacted me or I just went to his store, was Sam Goody. And Sam Goody was then located south of Chambers Street and was noted as a discount store, maybe the first such. He himself was a gruff man, but I always got along very well with him. In fact, the first time I went into his store, I was introduced as the author of the American Record Guide. And he says, oh, he said, then you know all about these old 78s. So I said, sure. He said, well, you see that pile in the corner? He said, go through them and put a price on them. And then when you're through, he said, take any 20 records you want as your commission. So I did that for him. And I also bought some records that I could sell. He gave me a very good discount, and I meant to bring it with me. I have the first check I wrote out to him. It's made out to Sam Goodowitz, because Sam Goodowitz was his real name. But Goody is the name that became important. And I should mention that I continued to do various jobs for him throughout the years, because in the 40s, in the mid-40s, 45 or 6 or so, if you wanted to open an account with Victor, maybe Columbia too, they would not sell you direct. They would say, go to Sam Goody and he'll give you a discount. In fact, he'll give you a wholesale price, which he did. And he was then located at 9th Avenue, just south, I believe, of 56th Street or thereabouts. But also, there were many other places to get records. And one of them was a barber shop. This barber shop was owned by a not very efficient barber, but a wise man. His name was Benny Mono. And he imported phonotypia and phonotype records direct from Naples. He had relatives or something. He charged $2 a piece. And I really stocked up. I had all the Della Chia phonotypes, and I had the phonotypias of Bonci and Russ and all the other singers you can imagine. At $2 a piece, why not? There were other interesting records to be bought that were not on the general market. There was a store on 42nd Street, the south side of the street between Lexington and 3rd, called the Elaine Music Shop, run by a Mr. and Mrs. Benjamin. And he had contacts. He ended up in the hi-fi business somewhere in Long Island. But they had gotten Victor to press for them certain Red Seal records with the brightest red labels you ever saw and the brightest black surfaces you ever saw, and printed on the back, one would almost say it emblazoned on the back, was the words Victor Records. And among the things I remember was Melba's D'une Prison, Destin's Au Conge d'Or, Clément, Ça Fait Peur aux Oiseaux, Patty, Norma, many very, very interesting things, and all in that beautiful shape. And those you may still find today, I really don't know. Across the street was the Commodore Record Shop. And their specialty was in putting out jazz records. Their stock was in the store was pretty good. They didn't care about the classicals especially. They would sell them to me even at reduced prices, I remember. But their own records and the jazz records, they were the ones who introduced Libby Holman to the market. And it was a good spot for me to go and buy records. The Milt Gabler was the owner of the establishment, but the manager was a very genteel person, very good to do business with. His name was Jack Crystal. And this now is a conjecture, but judging from appearances, I believe he was Billy Crystal's father. Anyway, he was a nice man. It was a good place to buy records. There were other places to buy records. There was the New York Band Instrument Company that published its own magazine, its own catalogs, and they were located on north side of 14th Street near 4th Avenue. And they also had a wonderful import department. And boy, did I get catalogs from them, because they gave me everything that came in from Europe they weren't interested. And there's where I got introduced to Supervia and many other important artists. I should add that I also stimulated my business at the store this way. Oh, I should say first that within a year or so, that little store on 53rd Street was too small for us, and my dad found a much larger store directly on 6th Avenue. It would be where the main entrance to the Hilton Hotel is now located. And business improved. And I had all these records that that I was buying at various places. I even ordered records of my own because I had a collector, a Viennese man with a sort of belligerent manner, but very strange tastes. If he liked a record, he wanted to get as many as possible. And for him, I ordered 100 copies of Victor 939, which is Maria Galvani singing the mad scene from The Magic Flute, you know, the Queen of the Night on one side, not the mad scene, Queen of the Night, and Una Voce Pocafar on the other. But he didn't like Una Voce Pocafar, so at my order, Victor pressed the Queen of the Night on both sides of this 939. I don't know whether it's around, I don't know where anybody would find it anymore, but it was interesting. Not only that, but I had to write to HMV in England because one of his great loves, whom he remembered from Vienna, was Selma Kurz. And her great record to him was a song called Die Vögel im Walde, the bird in the woods, on which she trills endlessly. Once again, he only wanted that, so I ordered HMV to put both sides to contain the same song, and those 100 records are the ones that I delivered to him. And I didn't charge him too much. He was a nice guy, and was always pleading poverty, although he wasn't that poor. I knew where he worked. He worked for the 30 Avenue Railroad Company legal department, and thereby hangs another story. At one point, he owed me, I guess, $600, $500. And I saw him on 42nd Street Broadway and said, hey, where's my money? You know, it's a couple of months ready. He said, don't worry. He says, I promise you within 1 month you'll have your money. Okay. So I let things go. 1, 2, 3 months passed, and I didn't hear from him. So I phoned where he worked, which I think is the first time I ever did that, but I was a little frantic for my money. And they said, oh, haven't you heard? He died 2 weeks ago. Oh. So they told me that the family, and I didn't know he had a family because he seemed to be so much of a loner, his family was running an auction and told me where it would take place. And I asked my father to go to that auction, which he did. And he went through the whole collection, which consisted of something like 25 broken records. Where the hell all those 100 copies of 939 or the HMV ended, God only knows. Does anyone here have either one of those? I wonder. You do? Yeah, it's remarkable. It's remarkable. And there were other places many stores put out their own records. Gramophone Shop, which was then, I think, run by Brogan, Tyler had left, was very interested in Maggie Tate. So you can probably still find today special HMV pressings of Maggie Tate selections from Berlioz or Duparc that were never released commercially, but were pressed for the Gramophone Shop. Schirmer's put out records of Nina Koschitz, which you may still find. Liberty Music Shop, of course, was very active. They had the rich show business crowd, and they put out a great number of records, Lee Wiley and whatnot, on them. And I would buy, you know, a certain quantity of each of these to have in the store. Well, things were going along well enough on 6th Avenue there, except my poor dad, who had a heart condition, which he shared with all of his 10 brothers. My father was one of 13 children, the first 11 of whom were all boys. My grandfather must have been a very pious man, I don't know. He was a very stern man, I know that. And he was really anxious to quit the business. He too was getting a little, how should I say, weary of dealing with bargaining customers. And so at that particular time, Jack Caden, who I said owned this business on 6th Avenue, a 7th Avenue, a wonderfully favorable spot, right opposite the Stage Delicatessen. You could sort of tap on the window and they'd see you and you could order a pastrami sandwich or whatever you want sent across the street, which is what we did. So Caden and I came to an agreement. I bought his lease, I bought his store, I bought all the CRS records. And believe me, some of them I had and hadn't had, but eventually they all went. And at that particular time, I was very fortunate in acquiring as a partner Christopher Bruno, who was with me in that store for 20 years, and without whom I would not have had a business and not have written the books I did. And so if he'll stand, I'd like Chris Bruno to stand, and you can see. But we got along, and being in a busier spot, we had to do more than carry out-of-the-way records or records that had very limited appeal. When My Fair Lady came out, we had to rush to where it was wholesaled and buy boxes and boxes. And when the novelty record, the first family, remember that came out? We sold hundreds of those. So we did a little bit of everything. The only thing was, little by little, starting in 1949, we started to see that 78s were not moving. Everyone wanted LPs. So by that time, I had enough business and could offer enough to them that Victor opened us as a franchise in Columbia, and we were able to order and sell the regular merchandise. The Victor salesman used to say we were one of the few stores that did their own ordering instead of letting him decide what should be on the shelves. And, well, to Mike, by now I should have offered my great thanks for all he's done and for that wonderful introduction he gave me. Mike insisted that on the cover of the book there be a picture of me and a biography. And you can't tell really from this picture. And this is back in my store, 1949. But if you could read it, you would see it's M1, M2, M3, M4. There was everything there. I made sure to have everything. And this was one of the reasons that we could do business in spite of Sam Goody four blocks away or Corvettes four blocks away. Because as you remember, those of you who, well, the same thing pertains today, those people offered discounts that we couldn't. And so we had very good equipment, and we were very kindly, maybe too much so at times, not as much when we got angry. We played the records for people. Well, they would hear it and say, "Oh, that's very nice. I'll come back in 20 minutes and buy it. I'll come back tomorrow and buy it." And of course, hasten down to Goody and save 25 cents, which is about all they could have, or even 40 cents. But that was the nature of the business in those days. The only business we could be sure of was the business in the items which these stores didn't stock, because they didn't stock everything. And therein lay a little danger, because some of the people would be so anxious to just see this LP set that they had been looking for years and couldn't find, that if you brought it out and showed it to them, they would put it in their hands, have an instant orgasm, and walk out of the store, and that would be your sale. And we had a tough nut to crack. There were 7 different New York City taxes that we had to pay, in addition to rent and everything else. And sometimes I would get angry. I'll never forget one incident. A little man about so tall, very pompous looking, with a retinue. I wouldn't call them bodyguards exactly, but they were sycophants, obviously. And this man's name was Oxenberg. And he's the one who had, I forget what it was called, the American Opera Society or something like that. He was the one to bring Maria Callas to this country. And I believe Sutherland gave her first New York recital under him. Montserrat Caballé made her great world success through him. So he was important, and he felt his importance, and he exuded his importance. And so when he came into my store, and it was late one night, because I'm a late sleeper, and dear Chris ran the business in the daytime for me, and I would get there maybe at 5 or 6, and the first thing I do was look at the cash register. They called me Tilly Cashbox Spiegel because sometimes I'd rob the register and just go out and come back a couple of hours later. But then when he left at night, I would stay, and being a lively neighborhood, I would keep it open till 1, 2 in the morning. I don't know what time he came in exactly. He came pompously to the counter and said, "You don't have the Trojans of Carthage, do you?" Well, the Trojans of Carthage, which is the second part of the opera, maybe the third, I forget now, was on a three record set from abroad. And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Let me see it." And I said, "The price is $45. He said, "I didn't ask the price. I said, let me see it." I said, "Well, let me see your $45. So it's something, you know, which I shouldn't brag about, but tickles me to this day. And sure enough, he plunked $45 on the counter. I went and got the set, and he bought the set. I don't think I ever again saw him in the store. But then, and I'm omitting a lot of things, because from the time I see, I'll never have a chance. I should mention, for instance, that a great source of supply to me was various places in Philadelphia. One of them was H. Royal Smith, the leading record store at 10th and Walnut, I believe. Very nice store, and they had things no one else had. I was willing to pay list price in some cases, and they put out a very nice bulletin for many, many years. And I should also mention that Sam Goody put out a bulletin called The Long Player that was superior to Schwann in its way. I believe Dave Hall and Abner Levin were its editors. I'm not completely sure of that, but it didn't last as long as Schwann did. And then, of course, there was the wonderful magazine Record Collective from 1946 on, who had wonderful articles with discographies. I wrote for them several times, and they were the ones to give me this absolutely fabulous review 2 months ago, which delights me every time I read it. But to get back to the record store, I should say that I believe it was mentioned we had very prominent customers. Stokowski, for one, who permitted Chris Bruno, to come to his concert and photograph him, and said to Chris at the time, "You may be seen, but don't be heard." And from those sessions, Chris produced some wonderful prints, which were bought up and appeared on at least two albums that I know of. He photographed a lot of other people, too. I remember another very good customer and friend of ours was Walter Toscanini. Brought his father in only once, but he came there a lot. And we remained friends always, in spite of a fact that was never explained to me, and doesn't have to be, but it's the way things go. Somewheres in the, well, I don't know the years now, maybe in the late 30s, I recommended to Victor that they bring out special pressings of old celebrity recordings that were no longer in the catalog. And I compiled a big list for them. And they said they would certainly take it into consideration. And then all of a sudden, I started to get lists of the Heritage series. And when I inquired of somebody, oh, this is very interesting. Who's in charge of it? Who sees to it that they get put out? And I was told Walter Toscanini. Now, what Walter Toscanini knew of Boronat, I don't know. But after all, he was Walter. And he was a good guy. Another good customer of ours was his sister, Mrs. Vladimir Horowitz. Her name was Wanda. And when they came in the store, he would go to a corner and sit in a chair with his arms like a wooden Indian, let's say. And she'd come forth and ask to hear Battistini. He was in love with all the bel canto singers. And I would play several for her. And finally, she'd come over and she'd say, Mr. Horowitz is thinking of that one. What would be the discount for him? Well, we were used to that. That comes along with celebrity, I suppose. But we had our troubles because Victor decided, as you know, to put out his own historic series on LP. I'm not talking about the Heritage, which were 78s, but they brought out LCT recordings and others. And they were meat for us. But they sold for $5.98. They cost us $3.71. And when I opened the paper one Sunday, I saw Sam Goody selling them for $2.98. Well, I phoned the local distributor and said, how come Goody is selling things at $2.98 and I have to pay $3.71? They said, oh, they're loss leaders. I said, don't hand me any of that blank. I said, he doesn't deal in things he loses money on. They said, well, you could look in his invoices if you want. I said, what do the invoices mean? You could invoice him for 100 records and he opens a box and all of a sudden there are 200. I said, you know, I know a lot about this business. And believe you me, unless I get the same chance to buy that he does, I'm going to get in touch with important people that I know. Well, sure enough, then I got a chance to buy them. And that brings me back to something that I should have talked about before. And maybe I don't have the slip here that, no. Here. In 1938, Columbia brought out Popular Records with a red seal. And in 1938, Victor sued them because they claimed they had the right to red seals for records. And during the course of some 5 years when this trial dragged out, and lawyers made millions and millions apiece, I made, I think it was $250, because I submitted a deposition to the fact that Columbia brought out red seals before Victor did, and that Columbia even later had used red labels on some of its foreign language F-series, and that Odeon had used red. So, but I wasn't called to trial. The thing just dragged on. And finally, on May 22nd, 1943, I saw this in the paper. New York, May 15th. Action brought by RCA Victor against Columbia and Decca over the use of red labels were declared void and dismissed this week by federal judge John M. Woolsey. RCA's charge of trademark infringement and unfair competition hinged on the red center label of Victor Discs and the words Red Seal, which had been used by the company for years to identify the label. The court, in dismissing the action, commented that records are not sold by color, but by sound. And Judge Woolsey declared he felt what the plaintiff dislikes is not what it is pleased to call unfair competition, but any competition at all. And then something happened. Have 5 minutes?
I was just going to tell you that.
All right.
5 minutes.
I'll rush this off. 10 minutes. Oh, very good. I must tell you two other things that helped us greatly. Victor brought out a label called Camden, which sold for $1.98. But Goody wasn't interested, because at that price, he couldn't discount it enough and still make a profit. So we, our little store, became the biggest buyer of Camden records in New York City. And Chris here drew up a big, big sign in which we identified the pseudonyms of these Camden records and who the real orchestras were. And they were a wonderful part of our business. And the same thing was true of Entree Records. Another thing which I owe to him, because I'm a little bit on the slow conservative side, I loved 78s and I didn't want to part with them, but it was LP, 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 and he came to me and he said, we can't keep all these 78s and stock LPs too, so we have to get rid of them. So we ran a 78 sale, a closeout, and we sold all 78s for 98 cents for the 10-inch and $1.98 for the 12-inch. And there went all my phonotypes and phonotopias and everything else. And you can all imagine the elation I feel today when I open up an auction catalog and I see phonotype De Lucia, minimum bid $250. Well, as I said before, I really never considered myself a very smart businessman, or I wouldn't be worrying so about money and where it comes from. Also, things that helped us in business, as I said, was we got to be known as the place where you could find something which couldn't be found anywhere else. Oh, another thing, you see these things, there are so many here. I told you important people came in the store, and one such person was Regina Resnick. And it so happens that I was quite friendly with a man named Eli Oberstein. In fact, I bought his personal stock. And Mr. Oberstein had brought out a whole line of records, Allegro, Elite, Royale, what have you, which were really bootlegs. They were the original bootlegs. They were mostly German, but other radio broadcasts, which he had put on the list. He brought out a complete ring cycle on four albums. And she was in the store one day listening to the ring, I believe it was of Alkira, and she was looking at some records, and all of a sudden she screams. She said, "My God, that's me!" And sure enough, it was. And she happened to have a lawyer for a husband. So she ran home, and she and the lawyer husband got to work, and the next thing you know, Oberstein had a restraint put on him that he couldn't sell those records anymore. But they still turned up for years and years and were in the market. And some of them were not that bad. Some were not that good. Also, I think I told you that I was very friendly with Eddie Smith, one of the most wonderful individuals I've ever known, or I think any collector ever knew. I met Eddie, as a matter of fact, in 1934, when he was living near Nostrand Avenue in Brooklyn. I met his mother. And he may have worked for Oberstein. He certainly worked for Remington Records and a lot of others, and put out his own records, Tap, Asco, what have you. Oh, I should say also, I did some work for Mr. Fischel, who put out Eterna Records, and was terribly frightened to use a Victor, that they would come down on him. And I tried to assure him that he wasn't important enough. Victor wasn't going to go after him for one or two of his records, which he may have transcribed onto LP. Because God knows, if they lost that case, then they'd really be as they were with the Red Seals. However, that's another thing. And Eddie Smith started to bring out his famous Grand Opera series, which you're probably acquainted with, and he really had the stuff. He had Metropolitan Opera broadcasts. He got them mostly from Lawrence Tibbett and other friends of ours. And there are even two records, well, I'll stop in 2 minutes. There are even two records which you won't see listed anywheres, which I brought out in cooperation with him, and they're the best sounding Gilly records that were ever made. Finally, I will end with one thing. Among the friends that I met, came into my store, great singers, was Giuseppe De Luca. De Luca, who went back as far as 1896 and recorded straight up to 1950, and he was kind enough to write the foreword to my book, which is right here. He died, not because of it, but a few months after the 1949 edition. So I've run all over the place and omitted probably 90% of what I wanted to talk about. But if you care to have me back 8 years from now, when I'll be 90 and a half years old, I'll be happy to continue the story. Thank you very much.
Mr. Moses, thank you very much. We loved that. Thanks again.